Two Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue.
Hi, this is Jeff.
Jeff, it's Dinky Dawson giving you a call. How are you?
I'm well, my friend. How are you doing?
Not too bad today. We were running around like crazy getting things together, and here we are in the podcast place. So I'm going to welcome you to Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain, Dinky Dawson. Fortunately, Tony's not with us today, Jeff. He's recovering, and that's good, recovering from a very bad illness that he's had since September, and he's getting better, and I think he's home now.
Tom, I was asking for him.
Oh, definitely. And then I usually have Peter to follow up. Peter Limbo would come and torture. Yep. He would have come and tortured you. He loves it. But he's not on the Cape, and I said, no, stay there. The traffic is wicked right now around here. Tourists are out. What can you do?
Right.
So you and me, you and me will have a quick chat about what's what. And basically it's just simple stuff. It's all about the channel and what we all did at the channel over the years and what have you, and what we enjoyed over the channel. And
excellent.
I know you did a lot because I kept seeing you coming in with different groups and also with systems. And that's the big thing I wanted to talk about is what was the first experience that you had with the channel yourself? What do you remember?
Well, it was actually, it's funny. You go back in your head and you're trying to remember everything and put a time frame together. And it's crazy how much time has gone by. And unfortunately, it was such a fleeting time of life. It went by so quickly, you know. But anyway, I was playing in a band when I first went to the channel.
I did not know that. What were you playing?
Yeah. We had a band called, it came out of the ashes of the Dick Wagner Band, and which was, Dick Wagner was Alice Cooper guitar player. And
I work with Dick with Lou Reed.
Yeah, Rock and Roll Animal album with Lou Reed, and, you know, just an unbelievable lead guitar player. And we became his band at one point.
Wow, I did not know that. Wow.
Yeah, recorded a record, which did get released eventually, many, many, many years afterwards, but, before his death. So we had a band. When that fell apart, we put together a band called American Teen, and which became quite big in Boston, and we played at the channel we played the main act, obviously, and then when the channel opened with Warren, we were over there all the time, and so we played the channel quite a bit, and in 80 and then in 81.
Yeah.
And so back in the day. Meanwhile, you know me. We've known each other forever, and I was mixing bands back in the 70s, and put one of the first in-house PAs in Boston in the Rat around the same time I think you did the Paradise.
That's 77. And, I think you're right.
Yes. So I had what we rented to the Cars when they got a deal and ended up putting that in there. So I've been mixing for quite a while. And was doing House at the Rat at the same time I was playing in a band.
That was when it was. I know we had some connection there with the Rat. I remember that one.
Yeah. And so it stems from that. And then, back in the day, when we played there all the time, my good friend Rocky was the house guy.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I became the monitor engineer there.
Oh, wow. I did not know you did that.
On Peter Vanellia's PA before you got in there.
Yeah.
And, we did quite a few things. And, I was doing all the local bands. I worked with Tommy Hambridge for years, and you know, and this band and that band. But when what year did you get back? Did you get in there? Was 80, what, 86?
No, 84.
84. Okay.
And well, I remember a lot of things with you is basically bringing in equipment and bringing in bands. You know, like, I think it was the Stompers, I think you brought in, you did somebody like that.
Well, I did. I was working on and off with Scorpio at the time.
That's so what it was, Scorpio.
Yes. So a lot of these bands would rent gear from, you know, from Scorpio.
That's right.
And then I'd troop it up there and, you know, bring in the KF, you know, 550
rig. I remember him bringing in stuff because that's something he did. Doing it, lugging it in one day.
That monstrous PA and setting all that stuff up. Yeah. And I think Carl at the time, Carl Daniel was mixing the Stompers and
oh, that's right. That's right, T-Boy.
I think brought a PA in. I had the luxury of working for some of the bigger bands as that decade, you know, went through. I used to do New Man and Fahrenheit, you know, after Rick left. So I had the luxury of having a budget, which was kind of nice.
That's,
you know?
That's what I thought that kept coming in.
Yeah.
Oh, this is good. This is real good. Now I get the whole picture. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Because you were in various... So I remember you with the Scorpio doing just because the group was renting the stuff from them. And then you had something that towards the end that you were doing at Michael Messina's place in that building.
I ran Sid Stone's song.
That's Sid Stone. That's it.
Yeah, I was actually – I started there in 84, and by the 90s, I was actually the manager in there and running the place. And, you know, we did all the small gigs, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's we did all the installs in around town and, you know, what have you.
Yeah, Sid Stone was good at that. The company that you had there was good at the installs and stuff because we had – contacts to all the equipment people, and
yeah, exactly.
That was the deal of that place to me. It was
it was fun having, you know, I had access to the truck and everything, so I would, you know, I'd like towards, you know, back in the 90s, I remember, you know, the money wasn't as good for what some of the bands were getting as it was in the 80s with like a heyday.
Definitely.
You know, but so I ended up, you know, I think when I was out on the road with the band The Joneses, we'd play the channel, and I would bring in, you know, a bunch of subs and amps, amp rack, and crossover, and then tie into your rig.
Yeah,
you know.
No, I remember because you know, you, Paul Hagar, would do the same thing with all the effects and stuff he had.
Yeah,
and outboards and stuff, and that's why I got that to PM 2000 so you could get the plug into anything and all that stuff. If I brought my old board on, the original one, you wouldn't have been able to plug in anything. You wouldn't even seen it because it was all black knobs and stuff.
My first console back in 76 was a PM 1000 16 channel.
That's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. It sounded pretty warm for them days.
Well, you know, it's as we speak, I'm actually up in my home studio, and I've got a 56-channel Midas analog console here.
Oh, thank you.
And as I remember, my PM-1000 wasn't, as 16 channels, wasn't much smaller than this.
No, but you've got more EQ on that and a better input attenuation stuff that you've got in them.
I question whether anything sounded as good as a PM-1000, though. Boy, it was a great-sounding console.
It was so warm for a standard console that you could buy after, you know, like we were doing. I decided, like I said, I did 1,000, and I said, let's upgrade for 2,000 from down at Maryland Sound. They had one, so I got that. Because you could plug in all your stuff and effects and gates and anything else you wanted at that time, and and have people traveling through that could do that and use that and get off on it. And like you said, if you wanted more bass, you could put more bass cabinets up with. But the big tubs took up room, but it was a place you could build that stuff every night. You could have put in there. And because of the size of people that came in there, it wasn't like trying to get anything in the rack. You know what that was like.
I remember doing a Nervous Eaters gig in there, and I came back after sound check and after dinner, and there was a line out the door and down the street.
Yeah.
It was like, how cool is this? You know, and the place was mobbed, you know, it's just crazy stuff, you know, but that was the heyday of, all of our business. It was, it was just so much fun. And, you know, I know on some of the other, podcasts that you've done, I've listened to some of them, and that place was a great place to hang, you know.
Well, that's one of the questions I was going to ask is, when you weren't working, what acts did you come to watch and also talk with friends and stuff and what have you there?
You know, I'm trying to think. It was funny because, as I said earlier, you're trying to remember all this stuff and put a timeline together. And in the meantime, I've made about a dozen phone calls to different people to rattle my brain, But, as luck would have it, I actually, back in the day, I used to cut ads out of the Phoenix, of who was playing where. And I'm looking at an ad right now for the channel, and it's a Tuesday night, and it was August, the band August and Breakdown and Boys Life. On Wednesday was John Butcher.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then on Thursday was Beaver Brown and my band American Teen. Yeah. And then on Friday was Levon Helm.
Oh yeah. That's right.
And on Saturday, it looks like some James Blood, I'm not sure, The Liars, but all these really cool shows,
Well, that's how I got the information on the database that's on the Best and the Best Live Rock, which is every year, is up there, and every show that I've got, which actually, every one of them I got out of the Phoenix. I went to Phoenix one day before it closed. And I had Brad and Steve Mindich, we were chatting and stuff, and I just ended up taking home probably a box full of a ream long paper full of all the ads I'd copied from 1980 through 1991, 92.
Wow.
And it was all the ads because there was so many special shows, and it was 7 days a week. I mean, and then even the week that you were saying about that, you had your new music nights, but also in the middle of the week, you're having people like John Butcher, and then New Man. I mean, just everything was just wonderful because you could have that kind of band, and then you as a person would be in town. And so I'll go to the rap player there, check out there first. I go over to this place and that place, and then come in for the last band at 12 because you knew they were going on at 12 midnight or around that time. So everybody else was closing, and people would just drive over or whatever way they'd come over, and they'd end up with a queue outside, still at midnight, still trying to get in because of they figured to get the last band, the best band at night, in the middle of the night and have fun,
Well, I remember, heading down the pike, from Alston or something and, pulling into the Channel parking lot, going down on the side and then just slipping in the back door behind the stage.
Well, you were always gifted to do that because you were part of the scene. I mean, you came in there and started stuff before I ever came in. And I looked at all this. I said that when Tony came in and started doing his thing, and he would check the back door. But I said, we had a discussion about all the people that work there and still, could pop in the back door because they know what's to do. And all of us were happy that people like yourself would be able to come in and see this stuff. you know, or be part of it, because if there was any kind of weird stuff, you'd jump to it like you did when you worked and stuff like that.
Yeah,
we all did the same, you know. I came in 81 to check stuff out with a group called State of Mind from South Shore. And
well, you know, I played in a band in high school with Steve Nicoletta.
Oh yeah. Oh no. Oh what a, and, no, what a
oh yeah. And no, Steve's as a matter of fact, well, not to change the subject at all, but I have tapes from 1973.
Oh, I love it.
He was 16, I think, at the time.
Yeah. A good drummer, though. And good fun and very creative of what he did, too, you know?
And of course, all those guys were good friends. You know, Robbie's still, you know, they're all still good friends. I talk to Robbie every once in a while.
Excellent fun guitar and stuff. I mean, all that lot was, to me, was interesting because it was like, wow, I could not believe this is local. I'm like, you know, yeah. I'm saying, wow, you know, and then there's one song I still keep thinking about, which is, don't want to be a tourist, don't want to have ice cream, you know, stuff like that. I mean, that one song slowed me that they did it for years. I said, when are you going to release that? That's a damn good song for somewhere around here and stuff. The tourists are buying, the locals are buying to get away from the tourists. The tourists are buying to say, hey, I'm a tourist.
It's, you know, so much time has slipped by, though. It's crazy, you know. It's
All of us. If there's not one thing, it's another. I mean, after there, for me, I played with a dream guy from my past, which is went to play in New York at Harlem at the theater there with Rick James. And loved the funk because he played at Channel for 2 days. And and then I took off with him and I was going to go on tour and stuff. And then he did what he did. But the thing was, is that night I was on stage doing monitors in an incredible show that he put on. Incredible show in New York. I was just floored. And he took me around, met all the hip-hoppers and all the stuff that was going off in the city in his bus. They all were coming to bow down to Rick James.
That's awesome.
What he'd done. And you know where that's at, when they've set up a funk. Like Sly did his business and stuff, and now we've just heard that Brian Wilson has passed today.
Yeah.
And you know, we're at that era where we've all gone through all these. I've had illnesses. All of you have had illnesses, and we just plodded on and kept going in our thing. I mean, I'm not engineering so much anymore. I decided I wasn't going to go out anymore because I'm stuck to a machine 4 days a week. And I didn't want to.
Well, it's so much different now today, too, with the digital stuff.
I don't use the digital. I hate the digital. Yeah. Digital's made for computers. You sat at home with a wonderful analog board. I will not deal with anything unless it's analog, because humans don't hear digital. Humans hear analog. We have to change that over in our brains on the digital, and it's messing all because of the earbud situation and things like that. It's messing your
brain. I've gotten used to it, though. You know, it's
you can get used to it, but I've been in situations where engineers, B.B. King's in New York, when I had Spanky down there 10, 11 years ago or whatever, Spanky McFarlane from Spanky and Our Gang and stuff, and all the Our Gang guys, and I had Denny Diaz from Steely Dan playing and all this with us. And I'm listening to this kick drum, and I'm saying, that's clipping. Why is that clipping? That's how it's supposed to. I said, that's not kick drum. That's digital overload, buddy. And they wouldn't accept it. He would not accept it. So I had to walk away. I just could not take it. It's terrible sound. You know,
it's funny too, because it's like dealing with all these younger guys now too. They should have learned how to mix analog before they got into the digital.
Well, they should learn of that exactly. But one thing, Jeff, is the big thing, is they should understand, they should get into a hall and not use an iPad, but their own voice. And yell, scream, and do whatever, hear the reflections, hear this, that, and the other, and work it out that. Well, now, the only decent thing about digital is the functions on the board. You can do many, many scenes, many things. So for a live thing like the channel, it would be ideal to have, because you can do six bands a night and have six scenes with no problems after a quick sound check from each one of them, and you pop them right up and press a button. You don't have to go and get the paper out and the little pen.
You remember the round circles?
Oh, all over the place. I mean, how many days, how much alcohol do we use to clean off the damn boards all the time, you know?
Oh, God.
But at the end of the day, if they don't use the earring, they use the computer. They use, if you see a graphic, you know, but you and I would use our hearing. We would mix to accordingly what's going on stage or what's going on out of the stage, because this guitarist might be louder than this bass player or whatever from the amps on stage. And most of the good bands today are now using a little bit of the amplifiers. They're not using the wall of sound, but they're using the sound system and the sound engineer to make it right and make it full and make it full out in an auditorium. And it sounds good, because that's where it should be at. If you have that wall of sound going off, like, remember Man of War and people like that, with that wall of sound that was coming off of that board?
Yeah, but it was a good learning experience, though.
Totally.
But like you said, that's how we cut our teeth and figured out how to get around things and, you know, to think on your feet, you know.
That's it. Today, though, a lot of stuff isn't that, because the thing that on the big scene that's going around is it's a show. And that means... Yeah. The engineer and the light guys and all that have done everything in sound in rehearsals, and they've put it on a flash drive. They put the flash drive into the thing, and the flash drive talks to the soundboard, it talks to the light board. All you have to do is not even touch a controller. You don't do anything. You just stand there and watch it, because it's set to what it should. But the bottom line is that you really need to be able to grab that fader here and there, because the sound in a hall is a little different than what it sounds in the rehearsal.
Yeah, I'm still out on the road. I've been mixing Spirogyra for the last few years, we're touring quite extensively. My buddy Pat Murray is out with us. He does most of the shows, and I fill in. And it's an acoustic band playing jazz, and it's we're dealing with a few hostile environments, but you gotta have ears to do it.
I agree. That's the only that's the statement, Jeff. Is you gotta have ears to do it.
Yep. And you know, it's I'm fortunate, because Spirogyra is such a dynamic band that they're not, as you said earlier, that wall of sound and craziness, there's a huge amount of dynamics that go into it, so it is just a pleasure to mix.
I would think so. I love the old Steely Dan, the old band. Even Mahavishnu, even it was loud, but it was contained in it. It was so well done.
Where it was really down, and then there were moments where it was huge. It's dynamics, and those players knew how to do it.
And they really do, and they work with the systems. That's the thing of the old boys and old girls. They would work with the system that they have, whether it be a two-channel. Old Shure vocal master or something, or the old WEM or any of the old stuff, because we never had monitors until Bobby got them from Fillmore West and the Fillmore East, and I got them from the same place. And I said, let's use these on the side. Well, Bill Hanley was changed over these monitor cabinets were actually the original stereo stuff. And all he did is turn them on the side for the Beach Boys and stuff like that, and put them on the side and use them, and they became rebels,
I wish I was a fly on the wall back in those days to watch what you guys were doing. It's it's so revolutionary. It's so secondary now, but in those days it was like you guys were pulling this stuff out, and it's like, well, this didn't work, but this works, you know?
Oh,
and,
yeah, that's how it went. But you were doing the same at the channel. I mean, just the channel, but all the other places you played, because every venue that you were doing, you were on your own. You're on with your buddies, and you're on your own, basically. And you're using your mind, you're using your skills, and you're using your spirit and what's going on. And I'm going to give this group my heart, and I'm going to do that. And they're going to give me back, and that's what that happened. And
I was watching a YouTube video not long ago of the band Shake the Faith that I mixed for many years.
Yeah, they were good.
And it was from the channel, and I'm thinking, my goodness, what a great trio rock band they were. I was blessed to have time with those guys, and it was great. It was the three guys in the band and myself and Jesse Albert, the lighting guy.
Oh, Jesse,
And we did, we were doing three shows a week with that band, but, we were playing probably the channel what almost seemed like once a month,
Well, that's most of those bands. I mean, the Fools, the Stompers, you when you're talking Shake the Faith, you're talking, there was at least once a month in the period in the mid-80s that we were playing because it would pack out every, and especially when, especially on the weekends, there would be people, like you said, lined up against the wall or the on bike nights, for instance, when all the bikers come, they'd all come line up and everything. They're all ready to pop in and have a good old time, But
we did, it's like here it is 42 years later that I am still mixing the Fools.
I love that. I love that.
I joke with everybody and say it's a condition of my parole.
Yeah. At least you don't have to wear the underpants or the undergarments like.
Oh, yeah. Well, somebody asked me the other day, it was Keith. Keith, the keyboard player. He said, does Mike still strip down to his underwear? I said, nope. Nobody wants to see that anymore.
They still want to see him dressed up as a Catholic priest and what have you.
Well, he still does that bit. And, it's funny. You think, wow, God, I'd be bored to tears after this many years. But every night is just fun because they're just fantastic guys. Yeah. We just played at the Bull Run the other night. And, I think it was sold out. And, it's I remember, as a matter of fact, the first show I ever did with the Fools in I think 82, 83, somewhere in that vicinity, was at the channel. And, it was my first night, me and Walter Lavash, and we had it was history from there on in. I've done just about every job in that band.
even played, I'm sure, because
I used to do sound checks on bass because the bass player never showed up. So I used to fill in for Doug at sound checks all the time. But I've been in every reincarnation of that band. As a matter of fact, I'm in the studio now. We're doing multi tracks of every show.
Mike told me that.
We're doing a documentary and getting tracks for live. CD, and we're archiving all this stuff for the shows that I mix and trying to put all that stuff together, which is, I got to do it in real time. Each time I do something, it takes me 90 minutes.
But I understand that one. No problem. I mean, at the end of the entire day, it's going to be wonderful because you're going to be happy with what your work is done because of them guys. Mike is a character and a half. I mean, we've had him on here a couple of sessions.
He's the best. He's the best. It's
fun writing. I love it. I love his crazy writing. His books. He's got his thoughts and everything. Yeah. How he does it. So I knew you were doing all these years and years ago, but I didn't realize you were still doing that. I mean, Spiral Gyro is just a whole wonderful world of sound. Wonderful world.
My good friend Pat Murray, I have to thank for that. I had basically retired during COVID, and You know, I picked up, there's a theater in Norwood, which I've picked up, called the Norwood Theater, of course. And,
oh,
and,
yeah, I remember that place, yeah.
Well, the funny thing is, it was my childhood theater when I was a kid. And
that's even better.
I grew up in the next town over in Westwood. So the, you know, so I took that over as the front of house engineer. And we've been doing mostly tribute bands, which is really, you know, what works well. And they're all high end tribute bands. So they're really, really good. And so I was doing that. And then Pat says, you know, a few years ago, he said, so you want to come out and do a Spyro, you know, Gyro run? And it was like, I was really nervous because I hadn't done anything in years. And it was like, I don't know, you know. And he goes, oh, you'll be fine, you know.
Yeah.
And so I shadowed him, and then I went out on the road with him for like 5 days. And you know, here it is going on 4 years later, and I'm still working with him. So
yeah,
I guess I did a good job.
definitely doing a good job. But it's good all around because you're part of the whole band with that situation, because that is a big deal to sit in and mix a band like that. Now you're doing a creative thing from what their point of view is you're extending it onto you, and people are just going to go, wow, that's, you know, because you're putting all those years and years of work behind you, and you're just putting love through what you know, and that whole thing really works well when you do that kind of stuff. When I went out with, I didn't want to go touring that much anymore. But later on, I decided I'd go out with Inner Circle when they had this number one hit, Bad Boys, and so it was reggae. So because I just loved the bottom end that Lance and on the drums with the D drum. And would have on the keys and stuff, and you know, it was just fun to wake people up at 8 o'clock in the morning in Switzerland when they were on a festival out there, and just wake them up with the Bad Boys sound, and just full an arena, you know, full all these people going absolutely nuts because they're all screaming, and because they were all couldn't believe the feeling that we're getting off the first damn number in the day. We really let it go, and I enjoyed doing that kind of thing because that was analog. I mean, working with on the WOMAD tour, and I did the same with them in LA and stuff. The guy came from the Riot House, the chef came from the Riot House, and he was Jamaican, and he said, "That's it, you're gonna all come back in there. I'm gonna cook you a huge Jamaican jerk meal." So we all went back to there. And then we went the next day and played again on the WOMAD thing, and the people were freaking out because they just let themselves down after that big Jamaican meal. They would just thought they were in heaven, you know, and they let it play with the feeling. And when you get that kind of feeling coming off the stage, and the people feel the music. Yep. I don't necessarily mean hear it blasting. I'm talking of feeling the note, feeling the sound. Feeling your bass, the way to say, when you hear that one note and it goes all the way through you without being too crazy, just feels good in the body. Isn't that wonderful?
I always thought, you know, my thought was with this is that, you know, if it's fun, it's worth doing, you know. And I never felt like mixing or audio in general was a job.
No, it's part of your life.
I don't know. There's something about it. You know, my good friend Seuss once said, he said, you know, he considered it magic. And, you know, it's, and I'm thinking, well, that's a great analogy.
Yeah, it is.
You
know? I was just thinking the same thing.
It's just kind of magic how the whole thing works. And you know, let's face it, we've had some pretty crappy shows here and there, you know. And, you know, that you walk away and go, good God, what am I doing? You know, and because there's so many problems that can arise, and some of them aren't your fault. Some of them are, you know, but we all know that a good sound engineer can make or break a band. You know, it's
we know that for sure. And we see that in the modern time with what's coming through.
Oh, You know, you've seen some people that it's like, you know, don't quit your day job.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, you know, I don't know what you're thinking, but, you know, this is not a career for you.
No.
And some of these people are just like, my goodness, you know, it's, hey, you know, it's fun too watching like people like Paul Haga, who's, you know, the kid in the group, you know, of us and, you know, the young guy and how successful he's become.
Exactly. Now, have you remembered, even with calling friends and chatting and stuff, of any fun nights that you remember at the channel that you really got off on? You mentioned the New Man one and stuff, but and also the Fools.
Yeah, more playing there. I think the funny thing is, you know, we played, you know, I have fond memories of when, you know, the band that played that we played in the, they did that Battle of the Bands thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And back in 81, and we were in that, and it ended up, I mean, there was all the notable Boston bands played, but it ended up being the Stompers won, and we came in second.
Wow.
You know, it was a foregone conclusion, I think, that the Stompers were going to win, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It would be because of who they were. And, you know, I'm not saying there was any shenanigans or anything like that, but I think it really came down, you know, to the right call. But, you know, we had a blast playing there. You know, and, you know, the other thing was, is, you know, I think doing a show there was an event, you know, you load in at like noon and, you know, when I was mixing the bigger bands, we'd load in at like noon and, you know, and we'd set up and get everything squared away, do a sound check. And there were always, as you remember, you know, five or six opening acts, you know, and
peel them off like you're in a store. You put the gear
doing
up.
30-minute sets, and then, you know, we wouldn't even go on until, what, midnight or something. And,
midnight to 1 o'clock. I mean, I was putting people on at 1:30 and some nights.
Oh, but it was an event, you know? It was like you brought all this stuff in to do this giant production and, you know, extra lights and...
Everything, lights, sound.
And, you know, whatever you could do. Your PA sounded, you know, it sounded fantastic. The vocals were so beautiful out of that PA. Yeah. And, you know, the only thing that, you know, it was the 80s, and I think we needed, you know, that kick drum, you know, in your chest kind of stuff. So, you know, we were always looking for more bottom and better mics for kick drum and, you know, and sampling kick drums and all sorts of stuff.
Oh, but, yeah.
You know,
I don't know
but
what
the
you're
sound
talking.
Of the PA was just fantastic. You know, it's definitely had some of my best shows ever there.
Well, that's nice to know, Jeff. I mean, I know you did some good ones because I was there on a couple of nights when you were mixing and when you were running around, and I was running around. I said, oh, this is good. It's so nice to have someone that knows what he's doing.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that for sure, you know. I mean, and it's amazing how many great engineers came out of our city, you know.
Oh, I've just talked with Scott Perman. He's doing really well. Paul Haga, oh my goodness, what Paul's been done over the years.
He just won a Grammy, you know?
Yeah. I'm saying to myself, these are guys that come out of the channel. And I used to get mad with him bringing in his stuff because he had to keep plugging in all the outboard. But he was learning.
Rack of death.
Oh, that's what it is. But he knew how to. He learned from the channel and more venues like that that he could plug up the stuff. He learned how to use all those gates and all those compressors and all that stuff he had in racks. And it sounded, and now he's got it down. I mean, he did that Miley Cyrus thing. He did the sound and stuff. I'm like, okay, it sounds exactly like the album because it was
He's quite, I haven't seen him in years, but he's quite an engineer. Do you remember remember when I was mixing Bobby Whitlock?
Oh, yeah.
And we did, you know, Peter Lembo was managing him.
Yeah.
And we did, I think, as I recall, we loaded in on a Monday and set up and did rehearsals Monday night into Tuesday, and then did a show on a Tuesday night. And I ended up bringing in my own console.
Yeah.
Paul was doing house, I think, at the time. So the two of us, I had my truck there, and we just kept going out to the truck, getting something else, and bringing it in, setting that up, and getting something else. And, you know, he had all his mics in there, and we just, you know, we had 2 days to play with stuff, you know.
So you were playing wonderful stuff. I love it.
Oh, we had a ball, you know. It's and actually, I do have a cassette somewhere. But the only thing I screwed up is when I recorded the show, you'll get a kick out of this, is you had the vocal only PA on like a Matrix or something.
Yeah.
So when I swapped to my console, I put it, I think, on an aux send. I don't remember how I did it. But when I recorded, I just took the left and right. So on the tape, it was band heavy, but not a lot of vocals, because the vocals were going to the accent.
That's right.
And it's like, I you know, when Bobby heard it, he goes, "Well, it's great if you're a guitar player," you know. And I had to explain to him what happened to the recording, and of course, he's like, "Yeah, sure."
No, I mean, I had that separate vocal system up there. That's one of the things in my little trips over the years. Is, you know, one left and right, stereo, full range, and then, you know, the separate vocal system with the horns and what have you.
Right.
So you could cover the whole place. You could wash it out really, really well. But if you wanted to do it the right way, you'd do the Matrix, and you'd do the horns were separate, and you'd put that in there, and that kind of thing. You would be able to mix it a bit louder here and a bit louder there. You wouldn't have to change up or a bit softer there or whatever's needed to match the system itself, you know?
Well, I mean, and it brought the vocals out so they weren't buried in the mix.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, yeah, because of that stage, it was a big stage. It would be right at the head angle where everything would be blasting in your head anyway. And it was,
as a matter of fact, I've stolen the idea at the theater, because I had a left, center, right in there by design. And so what I end up doing is I actually send the vocal channels to left, center, right. And then I have this in the digital world, I have a width control.
Yeah.
So I can take it and spread it out to the left and right.
Yeah.
So it actually gives me, you know, a real left, center, right
exactly.
Situation.
That's wonderful, wonderful to do that kind of stuff.
It makes such a difference, and it's like, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think about is like, I stole that idea from Dinky. You know, and I think all along we're always, you know, it's, you know, borrowing ideas from other people, you know, and it's like, but we're always so helpful to each other, you know.
Here's one for you, Jeff. The idea, you know, left, right, said the vocal cluster, left, right, rear, 5.1.
Yep.
Well, David Gray, my engineer, who was actually more to do with the lighting at Lou Reed, even though he was an electronics guy, took the information, and he was vice president of Dolby. He became vice president of Dolby.
Ah.
Because they changed it to digital, you see. And they have, and David just retired from there. But he told me, he says, "You've got to check out the Dolby Theater in Los Angeles." He says, "You're going to freak out at the sound," because he's got speakers all around the room, delays, all over the place, millisecond here, millisecond there. So it's like, it's so real, it's scary. It's absolutely.
Is that where they do a lot of the premieres or something?
Exactly. That's the new big place to do it, because it's so modern and so together. Yeah, that's exactly what it is, and whatever. And the sound is just impeccable when he really got that kind of delays in the right place. I mean, if you have the right system up there, and he using the JBL people to do it Although now Mark Gander's retired and all the good people up there that used to be there have gone because they're more interested in selling your speakers for cars these days. And
oh, I know. It's, you know, it's such a shame. Well, you know, that you mentioned delays, and it's like, you know, the one time I think I impressed my wife with audio was we were in a ballroom up in New Hampshire that I had designed, and all small delayed speakers all the way, you know, it was wonderful. A thin, long ballroom. And what's that?
Wonderful. I like that.
Yeah, and she was listening to somebody play piano, acoustic piano that was mic'd, but we were in the very back section of the room, and she said, "It sounds like he's playing right in front of me."
I love it.
And I said, "Well, that's because I did my math correctly."
I love it. Anyway, on that note, we should probably call this one because it's time for us, you know. Otherwise,
well, it was good to talk to you, Dinky, and catch up. By the way, you're still down the South Shore, are you not?
This is Plymouth. I'm talking from Plymouth itself right now.
The Fools are playing in Barbara's place on Nantasket Beach, the C Note.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for Barbara. Yeah. For Barbara Ryan.
We're down there, I think, the week after next. So if you're out and about, and you want to stop by and say hello.
I would come up for a sound check, but I can't really stay anymore. I've never been to a show in over 5 years because of this this illness stuff. But don't you remember Barbara Rind?
Yes, that's what, you know, I just mentioned her name. Yes, it's I'm looking forward to seeing her.
Yeah, she's a good lass.
Yeah. She's lovely. I mean, of course, I've known her since Jonathan Swift days, you know her and Jimmy Roach.
Oh yeah! Tell me about it.
Yeah. All right. So,
this is
all right.
Good.
Well, listen. Great to talk to you, and thanks for including me in this. And you have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you, Jeff Morley. This is Two Pints in the Corner signing out.